Welcome to the Calder Farmstead, your place for news, analysis, and shenanigans from the American Hockey League.
Face-off, blah, blah, gone, or shells, top, other point, fence, into the slot, a shot, and goal!
Long drive, Jake can let it, what a stop by Matisse with the left pad! Oh, there was a scramble in front of the net, denied with Matt Schichter by a miraculous piece of net binding by Matisse, can let it!
Dean from the red line sends it in, Hofer in the best net, he stops it, Hofer looking, Hofer firing, toward the empty net, he scores! Are you kidding me?
Now, with 9 minutes gone in overtime, the Bears breaking out. Right side with Fair. Brooks Light cutting to the net. Fair, and let's go!
Deal it from St. James Gate, Dublin, Ireland.
And home of a very green river, Chicago, Illinois.
Welcome to the Calder Farmstead Podcast, episode number 132. For St. Paddy's Day, Friday, March 17th, 2023. If you were hoping for a podcast featuring tips on integrating solar technology into sheep farming, we are not going to be much help. This is an American Hockey League podcast. My name is Sean O'Brien from StatsTrack and the AHL's only league-wide analytics guy.
And I'm Sarah Avampato from Four Press Hockey and SB Nation's Canes Country.
As always, we thank you for tuning in with us. And if you're new to hearing Sarah and I talk about hockey, we're going to talk about some news as well as dive in and discuss the goings-on of eight teams around the American Hockey League. We both watch a lot of AHL games. We're going to talk about what we see when we watch the film, as well as use some advanced stats to help us break it down. If that's new to you, you might want to head over to our podcast feed or YouTube channel, wherever you're listening to us from, and check out episode zero. It's a short primer on some of the stats we're going to be talking about, as well as how we view what's important on the ice. So if you're new to some of the more advanced hockey stats terms like PDO or the point shares model, or newer hockey terms like controlled zone entries or Royal Road, go check that out so you better be able to pick up what we're putting down. I promise it's not that nerdy or technical. It's only 20 minutes. And let's be honest, you wasted 20 minutes filling out a March Madness bracket. It was busted before you even clicked the link. You'll never get that time back. So next time, why not spend a little more time with us talking hockey? I did actually kind of lie just now. There is no league-wide news of note to really discuss here, unless you have something that I'm unaware of, Sarah.
The only thing that I saw was that, what's his name? The guy from the Penguins who took the time away to deal with his own mental health issues.
He's coming back.
Yes, he's coming back. I saw Sam Poulin. I remember we talked about it. Yes, him. I knew it was Sam something.
Yep. We talked about it very, very briefly because there wasn't much more to discuss other than he was going into like the player assistance thing or stepping away from hockey to kind of regather. I don't remember which one specifically, but that like he was struggling with mental health and decided to step away for a bit. And now he's back. And, you know, we didn't speculate on what it could be or anything because that's being a dickhead, especially to the people who do that, which shame on them. But it's glad that he's rejoining the team. The Wilkes-Barre Scranton Penguins certainly need any peeps that they can get at this point, especially as I was proven wrong earlier when I said that Alex Nylander was really unlikely to be called up because he'd have to go through waivers. But he was on Malkin's line the other night and looked – I mean, the Penguins are not good right now and should not make the playoffs, but he didn't look out of place, let's put it that way. You know, good for Sam Poulin for you know, taking time away to get himself right. Good for Nylander for proving me wrong that the Penguins would call him up and risk losing him on waivers potentially. But let's dive right in, Sarah. Let's start, as we always do, Atlantic to Pacific, East to West. We're going to talk about the Providence Bruins, and they've been one of the best teams in the AHL's Eastern Conference all this season. And in fact, they're very close to catching the Toronto Marlies, sitting just 3 points behind them in the standings. Is there anything the Bruins need to worry about as we head into that final stretch of the season?
So I do think that the Bruins are a team that needs to kind of look over their shoulder a little bit. They have been neck and neck with Hershey basically all year. The Bruins are starting to pull away a little bit from Hershey. Right now they're sitting at 80 points. Hershey was at 77. So, you know, they're starting to get a little bit of a gap there, but one hot streak from Hershey can change the way that looks. Both teams have won 5 out of their last 10. Providence has won 3 in a row, so they're at least on a hot streak right now. They have played Hershey 3 times since the beginning of this month. They have won each time. So that is huge for them in terms of helping build that separation between them. They've only got one more game against Hershey this season, so they'll be done seeing them, at least unless the playoffs eventually shake out that way. The rest of this month, they're playing Springfield, Charlotte, the Penguins, Hartford. So, you know, not a whole lot of teams that you're going to be like, this is going to be a huge challenge for them. Providence has been strong generally all season long. They haven't clinched yet, but you know, something wild would have to happen for them to not get that first round bye in that playoff structure. As things stand right now, I think they'd be playing the winner of Charlotte and Bridgeport. Congratulations, Charlotte. I'm going to go ahead and guess how that one shakes out. But you know, Providence in general, goaltending has been the story for them all season, and that's still true right now. Brandon Bussey has just been fantastic. He's top 10 in goals against average. He's second in the league in terms of save percentage with a 925 save percentage. All this from a guy that I don't know that any of us, you know, had we talked about Brandon Bussey in like episode 1 of the season, I don't know that either of us would have been like, ah, yeah, this guy, he's going to be second in save percentage. Like, I don't know. I wouldn't have called it, at least. I don't know about you. And it's good that Bussey in particular has been this strong because Providence in general allows a ton of shots. They average 31.45 against per game. The difference between them and someone like the Gulls, who's averaging 32.69, not nice, against, or Grand Rapids, which is 31.25 against, is the Providence also takes a lot of shots. So they're averaging about 30.45 shots per game. That puts them in line with teams like Milwaukee at 30.33. Coachella Valley is also at 30.45. So they're getting a lot of shots for, which is helping them generate that offense. And the goaltending is helping them on the back end, where they're allowing probably more shots than a team of their caliber really would want to be doing. There have been some scoring struggles lately. At the beginning of the month, they had 3 straight games where they scored only 1 goal. In each game, not just 1 goal total. Out of those 3 games, or one of those 3 games, it was a 1-0 win over Hershey where Providence only had 11 shots total in the entire game. And they still won. Hershey had 22 shots. So, like, obviously that's an extreme. That is not something that, like, Providence has done or will do probably again ever this year. But kind of indicative of, they're finding ways to win. The goaltending and defense is helping them even when they're having trouble kind of generating that offense. I didn't watch that one because I didn't want to subject myself to that, but I can only assume that that was probably the most frustrating hockey game on earth to watch as both teams just had nothing going. That low scoring streak doesn't really seem to be indicative of a trend. They have really righted the ship, but it does show that there could be some concern over whether or not that offense is going to go cold at the exact wrong moment again. In terms of scoring, you know, they have 177 total goals for. That puts them 6th in their division. Interestingly, Hershey is worse than them. So this is just a weird division when I look at it that way. They're 22nd in the league in terms of scoring. So if at any point scoring dries up and or goaltending takes a nosedive in the playoffs, that could be bad for Providence. Fortunately, everything has been running smoothly for them. In terms of their rolling estimated PDO, if you look at the chart, they took a real nosedive at the beginning of March, which is exactly when they started having all of these scoring problems. But things seem to be course correcting right now. Their last 4 games, they have scored 3 or more goals each time. So it seems like a temporary blip. But if you're going to look at anything to be concerned about, it is the fact that for a significant stretch of games, they seem to have forgotten how to do offense.
Yeah, their rolling PDO graph right now is doing some things.
Yeah.
Like, they're rebounding, but they are rebounding from quite the low point there. But they've had, like, before this dip, they had, what, 4 weeks out of the entire season where their rolling 2-week was below 100? Like, this was due. This was inevitably going to happen.
Right.
but it's going to go back up because only Wilkes-Barre Scranton can stay in this hole forever, apparently. Like, even San Diego has gotten, you know, goofy bumps. So puck luck. One of the fun things about tracking this is you can see just like when you see something like this where Providence hits that low, it's like, well, this is going to go back up. Nobody stays here.
Right. No. It's a weird chart.
All right. I think we could talk more about Providence, but I think that's a good place to leave it. We have seven more teams we got to talk about. Sarah, where are we going next?
We are heading to Charlotte. We're going to talk about the Checkers, where we have been highlighting Checkers players lately who have been in slumps the past couple of times we've talked about this team. Some even as a way to kind of try to break them out of that slump. We're going to take a different approach this time around, though, and talk about one that's hot. That is Lucas Carlson. He's got 5 goals, 7 assists for 12 points in his last 9 games. He's in the 99th percentile for AHL defensemen, according to the model. So, Sean, what do you see from Lucas Carlson?
I always find these to be the hardest breakdowns to do because I feel like people take away from them much stronger vibes than I intend to put out there. I think Carlson is a good defenseman, a very good one at the AHL level. Watching some of his game tape from the last 7 or so games, I can definitely see why he's not sticking in the NHL level, though. That being said, I still have a high opinion of him. It's just not 99th percentile in the AHL high. Like, if I had to ballpark where I would think Carlson like falls based on talent level, I would still put him in a first pairing grade, but it would probably be like 85th percentile, 83rd percentile. Like that's still really good. It still qualifies him as a first pairing defenseman, but like 99th percentile is awards, you know, ballot guy. And I don't think Carlson is there, but he does have good hockey IQ. He finds a lot of instances where he finds the space as a trailer on a rush chance where like it's a 2-on-2 or a 2-on-1 or something like that. And, you know, the winger or the guy with the puck along the wall will pull up and he'll find this big, he'll find Lucas Carlson just kind of coming right into the picture, gets him the puck. He walks into the slot and takes a high danger shot. He's scored a lot on those. He's generated quality chances doing that a lot. It's a big part of his game, and it's a main reason why he's on the score sheet so often. He also jumps into the play and finds soft ice in dangerous areas often. We talk about all the time on the show that being a hallmark of a quality modern defenseman, jumping into the play in the offensive zone, finding ways to join the rush, to join the attack. That's how you get on the score sheet in 2023 as a defenseman in professional hockey. It's not point shots and big checks anymore. He's an accurate shooter, but his mechanics aren't great. And I think he leaves velocity on the table because of it, though. The goal he scored against the T-Birds in late February was off a dangle of Matt Kessel, where he just undresses Matt Kessel with a very simple deke. But then he risks an absolute muffin that just somehow beats Joe Hofer low glove side. Like, it was a goal that as soon as I saw it go in, I was just like, yeah, Hofer is ashamed of that one. That was not a good shot. But it was all like arms. He didn't put his weight into it. He didn't get much stick flex. He definitely didn't drop his hips into the shot. So it was straight just a flicking of the upper body to put that puck into motion. But he shoots a lot from distance, like way too much, which is definitely one of the reasons he hasn't stuck in the NHL. You can't throw away possession like that with low quality shots. It's working for Carlson at the AHL level, but I think a lot of that is good luck. He's shooting 10.1% on the season as a defenseman. And while he does generate high danger shots on a regular basis, 10.1% is still unsustainable given how many shots he fires from distance. And a lot of his primary assists are from goals on tip shots. And yes, shooting for tips is a skill, as is tipping shots. As a player, I've done both. But wow, is he getting good luck on those tips? Remember, the guys who are making the tips aren't facing the goalie. They're just trying to change the trajectory of the puck. And yes, if you're good enough at it, you can consistently put a tipped shot into a space, you know, upper glove or something like that. But you don't know the goalie's not there because you can't see him. So there is some luck in it on all sides, of luck that your shot gets tipped, luck that you put it where the goalie wasn't. And the goalie, who's the poor bastard trying to save the tip shot, is just praying for the luck that it hits him because it's not going where he thought it was. And he doesn't have the reaction time to change his save selection at that point. But on quite a few of them that I've seen that he's gotten tips, I'm not sure he was shooting for a tip as opposed to just trying to shoot, you know, and put the puck in and it got tipped. And seeing that intention on film is difficult to judge, but there were definitely one or two where I'm like, he didn't try and shoot for a tip there. He definitely tried to shoot to score there and it got tipped. And he's gotten a lot of those that have just gone his way. On the defensive side, Carlson's okay. He's not great in his own end. He's not a shutdown defender, but he's not a liability either. But I think there are two points that do need to be made, though. He cheats out of the zone for offense a lot. Like, anytime a play looks like it's about to leave the checkers D zone, he's positioning himself to jump into that rush, like, immediately. And that has caused him to get burned and the checkers to give up quality chances and goals when he misreads those plays. It's not terribly often that it happens, but it happens because he's trying to join the offense at basically every questionable play along the boards in his own end. If he's not on the puck and he's the offside defender, there's like a play at the hash marks or like kind of the top of the circle where it's a board battle. He is positioning himself to jump in and join the rush of that puck out of the zone. And it's burned them a couple times. The other aspect that I do feel like we need to talk about is his work ethic. There are definitely times in which you can see his motor run low and him look actively disinterested in the play. Is it every shift or every game? No, it's definitely not. Like, I'm not trying to say he's, Patrick Kane playing defense levels of inactive. But it is mildly concerning when I watched about the last 7 or 8 games of his shifts, and I can see 3 or 4 moments across that time span of just, yeah, he's not caring right there. Like, he is just, whatever. Let's just get out of here. And, like, that's not great. It's not terrible because he's putting in points and, you know, doing his job. But those are definitely moments where, as a more established veteran, a guy who's played in the NHL as recently as last season with Florida, like, you don't want some of your younger guys seeing those moments and being like, oh, it's okay to kind of do that. Like, is that over-extrapolating from my end? Probably a little bit, but still, those are moments you don't need to be seeing from guys like that. In summary, I like Carlson a fair amount, and he's having a very good season. But his eye test does not line up perfectly with the model, and I think that's important to point out because the model doesn't measure all of the things, you know, that NHL models do. He plays a good game, but he's gotten some good puck luck this season in the AHL. If he wants to sustain this level of success, I think some adjustments need to be made. I definitely think he needs to shoot less from the point.
All right. So real quick before we move on, Charlotte is 100% to make the playoffs in the model. The whole money puck style graph is still in the works, showing each team's chances to win each playoff round and the Calder Cup. But while we're waiting for that fancy graphic, give us your thoughts on a Charlotte playoff run.
So yeah, that graph is taking a lot longer to make because of the AHL's playoff format that isn't a locked bracket from the beginning, which is annoying, and it takes a lot more work to make it happen. It's been a bigger project than I initially realized because I didn't think about if this team finishes as a 6 seed and they win as a 6 seed, that's a different bracket than if they finish as a 4 seed and win the first round. Like, I have to account for that change in probability each step of the way. And that screws up that means a lot more steps. But as for Charlotte making a deep run, I'm uneasy about it. They papered down Dalpy and Lyon, which is crucial because without the two of them, this is an academic exercise, basically. But I don't think they have the firepower to go toe-to-toe with a lot of other teams in the division. Can they win a series against Providence or Hershey or Springfield? Yeah, they can. Like, it's possible. I'm not saying there's no way. But I think they'd be reasonably sized underdogs in those series, and for good reason. Hershey and Providence at playoff strength are more talented at the top, and I think their depth is at least comparable to Charlotte. If in Hershey's case, I think it's probably better. But Providence and Springfield both also have a clear-cut edge in goaltending, even if Alex Lyon is the goalie. Like, I'm taking Brandon Bussey over Alex Lyon. I'm taking Joel Hofer over Alex Lyon. Like, Charlotte could emerge out of the Atlantic Division in the playoffs. It's possible, but I would think it's very unlikely. All right. I think that's a good place to leave it for the Charlotte Checkers. Let's move on and talk about the Utica Comets. It feels like it's been a while since we've talked about Utica. Yeah. So no one in this division can touch Toronto. It's pretty much a given at this point. They're going to win the division title, kind of like Utica last year, where it's like the last 2 weeks of the season is like Utica won the title. We already know they won the division. For the North Division, though, it's going to come down to a fight over that second and third seed. And that's between Syracuse and Utica right now. Utica has a 40.8% chance of finishing third in the division behind Syracuse. Do you think that's where they wind up, Sarah?
So, yeah, no one is reaching the Marlies. I feel like every Marley would have to get called up, and then they're playing like ECHL guys. And even then, who knows? The gap between number one Toronto and the rest of the North Division, like, absolutely blows my mind every time we look at anything in this division. Toronto right now sitting at 83 points. Utica, number two, 66 points. I'm bad at simple addition subtraction, but that is a significant gap between the two of them. In addition, nearly every team in this division has been on a roll recently. Aside from Laval and Cleveland, every team has won five or more of their last 10 games. And if we want to be nice to Laval and Cleveland and throw them a bone, they've each won four games and then gotten points in a fifth. So yeah, that's not nothing. Utica is 6-3-1 in their last 10. They're on a two-game losing streak right now. Obviously, they're not going to take over Toronto. So they want to focus on staying ahead of Syracuse, which the model says they won't. Utica obviously probably would prefer that they did. Syracuse right now has 64 points, and they've got two games in hand over Utica. The schedule coming up for Utica, they play Laval, they play Rochester, they play Syracuse. They play Syracuse five times before the end of the season. So in some respects, their fate is kind of, you know, in their hands. If they win those five games against Syracuse, that's real great for them. If they lose them, hello, third seed or beyond. In terms of looking at who on the ice is standing out for Utica, I have liked seeing Graham Clark kind of pop off this season. He's, you know, the motto has him as a first line forward, 88th percentile of players. He's been outstanding. He's a third round pick. He's already essentially doubled up on his points from last season. He had 24 points in 52 games played last year. This year right now, 47 points in 55 games. I don't know that he's a player that people expected to sort of pop off this season. But I think he's been a big driver for Utica. He leads the team in points, goals, assists, and just is having a real excellent season. But overall, like, Utica feels in many ways just kind of average. When you look at the stats on them, there's not a ton that stands out, either good or bad. They're getting the job done, except for special teams. Those aren't good. The net power play is 29th in the league. Net penalty kill is 25th. Compare that with Syracuse. They're 20th in the power play, 14th in the PK. Not amazing, not top of the league, but they're still getting it done at a rate that Utica isn't. Utica averages 2.26 even strength goals per game. Imagine if the special teams actually worked even a little bit better, what this team could look like. They wouldn't maybe be having this, like, will they, won't they, down to the wire in terms of positioning with Syracuse. The special teams were just, I feel like when I clicked to that tab, I was like, wait, what? Because nothing else really jumped out at me as this person's all the way over here on this chart or, you know, whatever. But those special teams are ugly right now. And I think that is something that, you know, that's a saying, like, you can't get through the like, you're not going to succeed in the playoffs without at least one good special team. They've got two bad special teams. So I think that is an area for concern for them looking forward.
I think the biggest thing of why their power play hasn't been working is, I have to look this up to get the exact number here, but this guy named Alexander Holtz has played 10 games in Utica. Yeah, that's probably why the power play has not been as great.
Yeah, that would do it.
Because no matter what happens, like, Utica as a team is not the same when he's in the lineup. Because usually when you have a star player who comes out of the lineup at the AHL level, you can kind of at least try and fill what they do with either one person or with a group of guys who kind of fill the gap. no one in Utica even approaches what Alex Holtz can do when he shoots the puck. Like, Graham Clark is a good shooter. He is not Alexander Holtz by a mile.
Right.
And to speak to about people not expecting Graham Clark to be able to make this leap forward, count me in that group. Like, he is a dude who for the longest time felt like he had the raw tools to succeed, but he could not put them together and wield them well. Like, he would get stuck on the outside on rush chances. He wouldn't be able to drive play in the inside, and he would just like make careless plays and throw pucks away. And it's, I'm glad, like, I'm happy that he's managed to, you know, to produce and be better at that this year. But yeah, it was something where, like, it felt like if he was ever going to jump off the page, or if he was ever going to like develop further and become someone who got NHL looks, it would be something like this, where just one day he woke up, and I know it's not that. That's not the case. He probably spent the entire offseason working on small things like that. So this is not a just, oh yeah, he just woke up one day and said, what if I were better? Like, a lot of
that's
work.
That's not how it works.
Like, he definitely worked hard to get to this point, but like, it was always going to be, you know, not him learning to shoot better or skate better or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's learning how to utilize those tools more effectively.
Yeah.
I think Utica's power play is going to tick up a bit here because they have a guy who can just rip pucks better than, I'm trying to think, is there anyone in the AHL whose shot I would take over Holtz? No. I'm sure there's probably someone. Oh, okay. Well, no, like, even Martin Furk, like, Martin Furk has way better velocity, sure. But in terms of like release and able to like shoot off both feet and like do, I still taking Holtz. Like, pure velocity. Yeah, obviously, nobody beats Marty Furk. But like, I still think all of the parts that make a good shooter, Holtz checks way more boxes than Furk does. All right, that's enough about Utica. Let's move on and talk about Laval. Sarah, what do we got going on?
So for Laval, the model came out with some surprising results recently with regard to the playoff probabilities there. It had Laval as a 46.5% chance to make the playoffs. Belleville is sitting at 12.8 and Cleveland at 64.1%. Why is Laval looked down on by the model so much here? And do you agree with that?
So let's look at Laval's remaining schedule here. 8 home games, 5 away, which is a nice split for them. However, they have this weekend at Utica, a midweek at Bridgeport, next Friday against Milwaukee before a 4-game road trip featuring Manitoba twice, Rockford, and Milwaukee again. That's 4 games in 7 days. A home game against Cleveland on Friday before a Saturday road game against Syracuse, and then they round up the season home with Wilkes-Barre, Scranton, Toronto, and Syracuse. One of those remaining games is a team that they are realistically chasing for a playoff spot. And only one of them is against a just straight up bad team in Wilkes-Barre, Scranton. Cleveland has 3 games in hand over Laval and is 3 points back from Belleville for 5th place. So that explains why they have a bigger piece of the percentage. Even if their schedule was tough, having 3 games in hand and only needing 3 points in 3 games, that's a big benefit. They also play Belleville 4 times before the end of the season. So Cleveland's ability to leapfrog Laval and Belleville is very, very big. Whereas Laval doesn't have the opportunities from the schedule to gain ground like Cleveland does. Laval's also just had their leading scorer in Tony Rick get called up, which hurts a lot. He is their leading scorer in Laval by 14 points.
Oof.
Laval also didn't paper down anyone at the deadline. 0 people. They did not paper down a soul, which means Belzile, Jesse Ullinen, not coming home. They're not coming back to help you. Raphael Harvey-Pinard, nope. Mm-hmm. Nobody. They are going to get nobody back. And Laval hasn't looked too good recently either. They've won 1 of their last 5. Their power play is 1-for-30 in that time span. They've been outscored 15-6 in that span. Even if they do sneak into the playoffs and get past that first round matchup of the 4-5 seed, do we really think that Laval is going places? Again, no reinforcements from Montreal other than getting Tony Rick back, which, yes, that's big, but no RHP, no Jesse Ullinen, Justin Barron, no Alex Belzile, nothing. They get nothing. they don't have the depth or star power to win a 5-game series against anyone in the North unless Caden Primeau magically transforms into Dominic Hasek again, which it seems more unlikely this season as he's been just wildly inconsistent again, and the Laval team in front of him is worse. So, look, I love the atmosphere in Laval. The pregame show they put on last year was the best in the AHL, and I was actively cheering for them to make it to the biggest stage and put that amazing show and that amazing atmosphere on the biggest stage the AHL could give them. They fell a game short, which was sad, but at the same point, like, this year is not last year. The DAC is stacked against them this year, and even to make it, they have the DAC stacked against them. And then, should they do squeeze in, like, they might win that first round because it's a four playing a five seed. Like, could they beat Belleville or Cleveland in a 5-game series? Sure. I wouldn't, like, that sounds like about as random of a series. Like, that's as close to 50-50 as you could possibly get. But, like, you put them against Syracuse or Toronto or Utica in 5 games, like, nope. Yeah. Do not believe they can win that series. Like, it's possible, but I don't believe it could happen. So if you're a Rocket fan, you can safely book travel plans in April, May, and June is what I'm saying. Like, have fun, go to the games, cheer on your team, but, like, I would not have hope.
Ouch.
All right. That is it for the Eastern Conference. We're actually making some pretty good time today. Yeah. But we're going to take a break here, and then we will get to Rockford, Manitoba, Bakersfield, and San Jose. If you're just here for an Eastern Conference team, and this is your jumping off point, thank you for stopping by. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you're listening to us from so you get episodes in a timely fashion. Also, check us out on social media. We try and have some fun there. Links to all of our social media and more can be found at our Linktree page at linktr.ee/TheCalderFarmstead. We're going to pay some bills, chug some beers, and be right back. Stay tuned.
All right, welcome back to the Calder Farmstead. Thank you so much for checking back in with us. If you just fast-forwarded past all that Eastern Conference stuff, welcome. Hi, we're going to be talking about the Western Conference now, and we are starting out with Rockford. We're going to take a look at the Rockford Ice Hogs, where last season Arvid Soderblom was a finalist for our Best Goaltender Award. He helped carry a basically offensively inept Ice Hogs team in the 2021-22 season to a playoff series win over Texas. This season, looking at the stats, it looks like night and day for him. Last season, he was at a 919 save percentage, stopped almost 20 goals above average, and was a quality starter rating by the model. This season, he's at an 898 save percentage. He's given up almost 4 goals more than average, and has a replacement level rating by the model. So what has happened to the Ice Hogs goaltender?
In short, not a whole lot from what I see from him. Let's go back to 21-22 for a second and explain this a bit, because how we got here makes sense as to why he's struggling, but also is seemingly unlikely to change. Last season, the Ice Hogs' basic blueprint for winning games was to grind out an ugly lead and then batten down the hatches. They'd give up a ton of shots, but they'd defend the high danger area as well and make sure that Soderblom had clean sight lines, if he didn't swallow up the rebound, a defenseman was there to take care of it and make sure that no offensive player was able to, you know, get a stick on a rebound. This strategy makes sense as the Ice Hogs didn't have a ton of offensive talent and had solid defensemen who could defend the net front well. Ian Mitchell, Ryan Stanton, guys like that. This strategy worked well for them, all things considered, and they were able to grind out a lot of low-scoring, low-event games that were not aesthetically pleasing to take in as an analyst. But still, Sarah, I'm sure, recounts many of them that were just, God, not another, you know, 2-1, 3-2.
Every time.
Ugh. This season, as we've talked about already in depth, the Ice Hogs team strategy has shifted significantly. They've gone from a low event, grinded out offense with little talent to a dynamic one featuring a lot of capable scorers like David Gust and Brent Cini, and now Rocco Grimaldi. That also means the hatches defense they played is also gone in both strategy and roster construction. The Ice Hogs this season are hot ass garbage at defending the net front, and the right side of their defense features luminaries like Louis Crevier, Andrew Perrott, and Andy Wilinski. Now, Andy Walensky can move the puck and run a power play, but is not much of an in-zone defender. They've also been working in Coltrane Wilson for some reason, who sounds like a video game character as opposed to an AHL defenseman, but what have you. Alex Regula is hurt. Adam Clendenning is gonzo. So right now, the Rockford IceHogs have zero right-hand defensemen on the roster that could adequately defend the net front. And to be clear, defending the net front isn't about having size and strength either. Crevier is listed at 6'8", 228 pounds, and he's not good at defending the net front. Coltrane Wilson is a big, physical, tough dude, and he sucks at defending the net front. Defending the net front is about leverage, body position, and keeping track of where threats and passing lanes are all around you. Complete situational awareness, as Archer would say. If you watch the goals that are getting scored on Soderblom this season, not too many of them are anything you could even pin on him as doing wrong other than he didn't make the save. There are a lot of high danger chances that were poorly defended. The goal Joel Lesperance scored on the power play against Grand Rapids the other day sums it up nicely. And I believe we have a picture here to add, just a screenshot, but still, this is Joel Esperance at the net front about a second before he scores. Does anyone see the problem here? If you're listening on the podcast, just picture a guy in a Grand Rapids jersey with zero defenders within 5 feet of him just hanging out at the top of the crease. Also, Sarah, this is a diamond penalty kill structure, isn't it?
It sure is. It looks...
Friends don't let friends play diamond bad. Penalty. For exactly this reason.
Like, why have they done this? Why did they do this? This is so bad.
And like, this isn't even the only instance of like, wow, that was a really poorly defended net front or someone got lost in coverage. Like I watched the Marley score one where they literally let a pass just go right across the crease. And there wasn't even like a defender there who missed it. There was nobody. Like, it was a shot pass from the point to the far post, and the guy just tips it straight across for an empty net. And it's like, if you're Arvid Soderblom, like, what were you supposed to do there? Like, and that's where a lot of the goals that are scored against him, like, even the two off the face-off against the Marlies recently, it was like, oh, Coltrane Wilson made the same mistake on two faceoffs in the same game that led to that goal going in. Like, a more competent defense in front of Soderblom shoots his save percentage up massively. Like, it's like, yes, Soderblom, you know, has had some problems this season, but like, even on that Joel Lesperance goal, the announcers for Grand Rapids were like, wow, Joel Lesperance is really just standing in front of the net with no one around him. That's bad when the broadcasters for the other team realize your defensive ineptitude.
Yeah.
And yes, Soderblom was a finalist last year for best goalie, and deservedly so. And he won't be this year. And some of that is on him. Has his rebound control been a little shakier this season? Sure, a little bit. Has he maybe not been as sharp at times and let in some bad ones? I will absolutely concede, yes, he has. But my God, his defense needs to step up and give him a hand. You can't have passes going cross crease for backdoor tap-ins and then turn the goalie and be like, come on, man. Like, that's not how this works. Environment in front of the goaltender is almost more important than the goaltender. Soderblom hasn't been as sharp this year, but the team in front of him has just been so much worse at defending the most important area to defend, the front of the net. That's why I don't think Khudobin comes in and solves many problems for the IceHogs. The defense is the problem, and they can either try and outscore them, which maybe, or they can coach up their D on better net front play. I'm just going to lightly assume that the coaching staff has been trying to do the coaching up part the whole frickin' season. So I guess it's in time. It's now time with Rocco Grimaldi and Gust and everyone there to just start say, you know, if we can score 6 goals to the 5 we let up, that is still the same win as if we win 2-1. So that's what I think is going on with Arvid Soderblom. Sarah, any additional thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I know that he was dealing with injuries throughout the season as well, and I'm sure that that has played some impact. But yeah, I mean, you can't deny, I mean, that their blue line right now is just atrocious. Like, those are not, like, those are guys who should not be, like, why are they here? And I know that, you know, Soderblom got a look in the NHL this year when he wasn't hurt. And he looked fine to the point where people were like, have the Blackhawks like finally got a goalie in the pipeline again. And then I looked up his numbers, and his numbers are terrible in the NHL. But I feel like every game that I saw him in, I was like, well, that's not on him. I mean, the team in front of him in Chicago is not any, you know, not really much different from the team they have in Rockford in terms of like protecting him. But yeah, I think he's a better goalie than what we're seeing from him this season. And I think a lot of it is, yeah, that Joel Esperance goal of like, what is he going to do? What is he going to do about like, they let him, it's Joel Esperance. What do you think he's going to do? He's going to score.
Yeah, Lesperon's got like three whacks at that rebound.
Yeah,
before it went
in. No one's like, there.
If you're letting a dude get three clean chances at a rebound, that's on your defense. Like, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
All right. I still like Rockford though. I think they're going to be a team that can go places in that they're on my bingo square for winning the division out of the playoffs, like in the Calder playoffs. So I at least believe in them enough. Like, I think they can do it. There's enough good pieces there to figure out a way to make this work. But right now, saying that Soderblom isn't stopping enough pucks is just not doing analysis correctly.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on and go north and talk about the Manitoba Moose. Sarah, the top of the Central Division has stabilized somewhat, and it looks like it's going to be a fight to the finish for the Manitoba Moose. They've still got dreams of finishing in that top spot in the Central, but they're going to have to go through some good teams to get there. What has life looked like for the Moose lately?
So in their last 10 games, they are 5-3-1-1. They have lost their last three. So a little bit of a lull for the Moose right now. When you look at their lineup, though, they haven't really lost much in terms of players going up to Winnipeg. There weren't really a ton of moves that, you know, at the deadline, not a lot of changes. So the roster they're working with is the roster that they're going to be working with. One big thing to point out is, you know, Alex Limoges having a career year with the Moose. He's got 45 points over 51 games played last year when he was part of the Gulls organization, 40 points in 62 games. So obviously kind of blowing that out of the water. Also, interestingly, his goals and assists stats from last year to this year have basically completely flip-flopped. Last year he had 17 assists. This year he has 29. I think he's getting a lot more opportunities to make plays here in Manitoba. I think he's getting a lot more, you know, probably a lot more ice time, more usage than he was with the Gulls, who had a little bit of a deeper lineup last year. I mean, obviously much different than this year's lineup for the Gulls. But I think Limoges is getting more of an opportunity with Manitoba to make plays. And more importantly, maybe has the teammates to help him out that he wasn't necessarily on a line to do when he was with San Diego. When we look at the model, it has him as a first line forward in the 89th percentile. When you zoom in, he's sharing a spot on the model, basically with guys like Matthew Highmore, Kiefer Sherwood, Taro Hirose, guys who maybe aren't like superstars, but who have all been pretty important to their team's success in helping drive that offense. So he's in a good spot. Looking at the model for Manitoba, it doesn't really love their goaltending. Both Arvid Holm and Oskari Salminen, both rated as backups. Salminen in particular seems to be able to steal games every so often, although maybe it's just because I always see him beating the Wolves, and maybe that's colored of my perception. But I think that in general, the Moose do an average job of protecting their goaltenders. They're about dead even in terms of even strength shots taken and allowed. Their goaltenders are getting it done, but maybe not, you know, that otherworldly goaltending that you'd want to see from a team that wants to try to climb up to the top of the standings. We've talked a lot this year about Ville Heinola. He wanted to get traded. That you know, remark was out there from his agent. My bingo square of him getting traded didn't come true. There's always a draft day trade possibility, but for right now, he is on the Manitoba Moose. Looking at the Jets situation, they don't have much by way of picks in 2023. So, you know, would they consider moving him to help bolster that? Maybe. He has one more year on his entry-level contract. He's an RFA after next season. So the team has all the leverage here. There is no incentive for them to move him at any point. Per cap friendly, he's probably not even going to need waivers until the 2024 season. So the Jets have a lot of flexibility with him as well. He is third in defensive scoring on the team overall. But when you look at points per game, he is the best of their defenders. He's got 27 points in 35 games, which is 0.77 points per game. Overall, though, he is doing what you want to see a player in his position doing, even if he's not happy about it, even if he is not thrilled to still be a Manitoba Moose. At the end of the day, if he wants the Jets to move him or if he wants the Jets to finally give him an NHL spot, he has to play and play well here. And unless the Jets call him up as a black ace for the playoffs, he is going to have a great opportunity to help lead this team in the AHL and show what he can do. Overall, looking at the Moose, their strength of schedule as the season winds down, they play Chicago three times, Rockford three times, twice against Laval, Abbotsford, Grand Rapids, Texas. Those games against Chicago, Laval, Grand Rapids, those should all be winnable games for Manitoba. Finishing the season on the top of the division isn't out of the question. Texas has 72 points. Manitoba's in third with 70. So it's going to be a dogfight between them and Milwaukee, all at the top of the division. Manitoba's got about a 17% chance to win the division, but anything can happen, and it's going to be a fun race to watch as the Central winds down this year.
Yeah, Manitoba start to finish has just been a team that's like, yeah, their blue line is good. And then everyone else is just kind of like, Limoges has had a great year for them, and that's, I wouldn't say surprising. I didn't think he would be this good, but he's had a great year. And then everyone else on that team is just like, yeah, that's a pretty, you know, like average-ish, maybe a little better, a little worse AHL kind of guy for that role. Like, they don't have a lot of sex appeal besides Alex Limoges' hair. That is...
Beautiful.
It's always been an unflashy kind of team. He's probably going to be a finalist for best hockey flow again this year. Like I haven't gone through and, you know, picked out candidates for the ballot quite yet. Like, he's definitely going to make it, but
deservedly so.
I haven't scouted the competition against him yet, but it's very likely two-year running finalist. So especially like he has an opening because was it Anthony Lewis and his teammate Fialbi, Gonzo?
They're
not going to qualify for the award this year. So
yeah, that's right.
He has the opening to pull a W here. As much as I would like to not bias our award, he is a Penn Stater. So there is that going for him.
Yeah.
All right. Sarah, let's move to the West Coast, the best coast. Let's talk about one team in the Pacific Division that definitely has playoff aspirations and could do things, and that's the Bakersfield Condors. After a very hot start to the season, though, they're still trying to dig themselves out of that mid-season kind of lull where they were running a skeleton crew. Injuries and call-ups have definitely tested their roster, but they are firmly in a playoff position as most of the division, the Pacific, is like the least interesting race. But they've been playing well lately. What's working for the Condors, and what do they need to look out for?
So they have been on an absolute tear lately, 7-3-0. They've been turning in wins against the teams that they want to be beating and the teams that are ahead of them in the standings. They just like decimated Ontario recently. They've been doing it well. In terms of goaltending, they did get Calvin Pickard back in January from injury. He hasn't looked great, though. In some ways, it kind of looks like he's trying to figure things out after that injury, which, of course, is like nebulous because no one ever tells you anything in the AHL. But he was hurt in some way. He's always been a fairly athletic goalie, so you also kind of have to wonder, is time catching up with him at this point? The speed and that like cleanliness of motion doesn't seem to be there in the same way that I'm used to seeing it from him. Olivier Rodrigue has been kind of shaky. In the game against Coachella Valley, for example, there was an odd man rush that he just completely misjudged. And he is not athletic enough of a goaltender to be able to make up for reading that play wrong. And so when you're making mistakes like that, you're not helping your team out. Would it have been great had they not allowed the odd man rush in the first place? Yeah, sure would have been. But it happened, and he had a 50-50 shot and picked the wrong one. Their roster in general has been more stable as Edmonton's situation has stabilized with all the injuries they've been dealing with. So that has been good for them. They did paper transaction down Devon Shore and Philip Broberg. So both of those guys are currently up in the NHL, but are eligible to return to Bakersfield for the playoffs. If, say, perhaps, I don't know, the Oilers get eliminated early, they could send them back down and they'll be able to play for Bakersfield. They also acquired Cam Dineen, who we've talked about on the show before, I think will be a pretty good asset for them as well. They're currently on a 7-game homestand right now. The 7th game is actually like probably just finished recently. Game 7's Friday. Today's Thursday. Game 7 would be tomorrow, Friday. In 3 of those games in that homestand, they have scored more than 5 or more goals. In the 3 games where they didn't so far, 2 of those were losses, a 5-1 loss to Coachella Valley, a 4-0 loss to San Jose, and then 1 win, which is a pretty tight 2-1 win over Texas. So that offense is very inconsistent from Bakersfield. When it's good, it's good. When it's bad, they're getting trounced by teams like the Barracuda. The penalty kill has not been helping them lately. In that loss to the Barracuda, they allowed 2 power play goals on 6 attempts. Their own power play went 0-3. They had a 6-5 win over Texas, a totally wild game. Texas got 2 power plays, scored on 1 of them. The loss to Coachella Valley, they had 5 penalties. Coachella Valley scored on 1 of them. And also their power play again went 0-6 in that game. So penalty kill not helping. Power play also a little shaky. You get 6 chances. You think you should be able to score on 1 of them. They are averaging 4+ penalty kills per game. That is not helping them improve their position. If they're constantly killing penalties and they're not great at it, that is not going to help you score goals and win points. They do kind of need to keep one eye in the rearview mirror there, though. It is more than likely that Bakersfield is going to get into the playoffs. Right now, Bakersfield and Tucson have those last spots in the Pacific. Like we said, it takes a lot to not make the playoffs in the Pacific. Basically, everyone gets in. But Tucson and Arizona just said that they're keeping goaltender Ivan Prosvetov up in the NHL. That is going to tank Tucson because they kind of need him. So that does not look good for the Roadrunners, Arizona has said, like, oh, we want to bolster Tucson for a playoff run, but also we're taking your goaltender. So, yes, that's the face that I made. Also, when we're looking at them, you know, San Jose is just 5 points behind Bakersfield. They've won 6 of their last 10. They've been playing well despite losing some key players to call-ups to the NHL. Is it possible for the Barracuda to jump up? Anything's possible, honestly. For the Condors, they play Henderson twice. Those should be easy wins, you'd think. Henderson's been kind of better lately. Not great, but, you know, slightly better. They play Coachella Valley 4 more times to end out their season. And I think those games are going to be, like, make-or-break ones for the Condors. If they lose all 4 of those games, that's going to be ugly. They have shown that they can beat Coachella Valley, but are they going to be able to do it on a consistent basis? Maybe not. At the beginning of the year, when we talked about Bakersfield, they were a team that was playing well enough to win. They weren't great. They weren't terrible, but they were just, the coin was flipping in their direction. And it kind of feels like we're seeing that again right now. They're winning games somehow. The rolling estimated PDO is in the gutter at the moment. Like, it is ugly. So is it going to rebound? You'd think so. It's just a very weird position for the Condors, who are winning games that maybe they shouldn't be winning, but I also don't know that I trust them to keep doing that at any point.
To be fair, off of a massive bender here. So yes. This is starting to rebound back up, but like this crater was absolutely inevitable. It's like every time you see some big high point here, like happened. Every once in a while when I post graph updates, I'll be like, I'll pull out one of these, like, I wonder what happens next here. I wonder what happens next here. I wonder what happens next here. I think Bakersfield might have even been one where it's like, yep, they're at 107 on February 14th.
Yeah.
I wonder what happens next.
Yeah.
Like, this is the way puck luck works. It goes up and then it goes down and then it goes back up again.
Yeah.
Like, enjoy the ride. But we're going to talk about San Jose and their playoff chances here. So Sarah, let's talk about San Jose, go over to them.
All right. So I saw your Twitter post about Nick Cicek. I know you want to take a victory lap here, but I think the more interesting defenseman to talk about is Artem Nashev. He has gone from being on a miserable Barracuda team last season, finishing in the 13th percentile with a replacement level grade. This season, he's on a regular bad Barracuda team. He's in the 73rd percentile second pair defenseman grade. So what have you seen from him in regard to his development?
So first, let me pull out this imaginary list here of people who I am, in fact, accountable to. You're not Melissa O'Brien or my day job boss, Brenda. You're not Angelo, my beer league captain. Christina Hendricks? No.
Unfortunately not. No.
Bobby Orr? No. Mm-mm. Timothy Dalton? No. Mm-mm. Connor O'Brien? No. Ew. Lisa McGee? No. Allison Lucan? No.
God, I wish.
So that says to me, you definitely do not have the authority to cut off a victory lap from me.
All right.
Which I wasn't really going to do. I wasn't going to do the I told you so victory lap. But then you went and Susan Sarandon affected yourself. And now I definitely am, because fine. Tell you, I most certainly did.
Fine.
Here is in my own words from April 2022. CC, cue it. I do want to highlight one negative for San Jose in particular, though. Nick Cicek can skate well, or Cicek can skate well. He has some good instincts in the offensive zone. He activates off puck into the rush a lot and is effective in doing so. But he is truly terrible on breakouts, fielding pucks off the wall and dump-ins. He's not good in board battles. He's listed at 6'3", 200 pounds, and he lost a board battle to 5'10", 185-pound Colt Conrad. He lost battles in the corners and the net front repeatedly. He got absolutely bodied by Alan Quine off a puck on the wall. He's found new and innovative ways to turn the puck over on breakouts, including one around the 13-minute mark of the second period of Sunday's game. If you want to go look it up, I genuinely had to hit pause and just like yell into the abyss, what are you doing? He skated himself into a corner and then like made a blind rim around and got instantly picked off by Henderson under the most minimal forechecking pressure imaginable. It was bizarre. And that hasn't been a new development in my viewings of Cicek either. This wasn't just like a good player having a bad weekend or just an off, you know, two games. Like, this is what I've seen from him every single time. But today San Jose announced a 2-year NHL contract for him, and I don't get it. I have no idea what they see in doing that. He has some offensive upside. Like, he's not without any skill, but like, he's absolutely a net negative for that Barracuda team. And I don't think it's going to get much better. According to MoneyPuck, of NHL defensemen who've played at least 200 minutes, Nick Cicek is 215th out of 242 defensemen in expected goals percentage this season. He's 239th of 242
no.
in actual goals percentage in the NHL this year. In 27 AHL games in this season, he's in the 0.3 percentile according to the model. 0.3.
It's not even a number.
To tell you he was not good. I tried. Okay, let's talk about Nashev because he's making positive moves this season. Last season, I don't think was as bad for Artem Nashev as the numbers show because the whole team was a gong show. Kind of like what San Diego has been this year, which I'm sure is just a coincidence. But Nashev's defense in zone was not good last season. He was getting fixated on puck carriers and wouldn't scan over his shoulder to see threats behind him. He would chase the play. He was overly aggressive defending rush chances to the point where he would just like pivot and charge puck carriers in the neutral zone in moments that he had no business doing. That's improved a lot this year because those mistakes are very fixable and coachable. And I mean, any coaching staff, like I'm not going to give a ton of credit to the Barracuda staff for fixing that because like you would have to be, you know, a blind man to not be able to help him in those situations. And even still, I've seen movies where there are in fact some incredibly useful wise old blind men. So like maybe even a blind staff could have helped him, but like his offense has also grown. He's been valuable in transition this year and will jump into the rush early and often, which has helped San Jose generate offense this season, as they have been at times comically inept at neutral zone and in transition. He's aggressive in attacking space in the neutral zone and can beat forecheckers with his skating. He's managed to grow as a power play quarterback like a tiny, tiny bit, albeit not as much as I would have liked to have seen. But hey, progress is progress. We'll take it wherever it's given to us. The problem is that he gets tunnel vision in the offensive zone with the puck, and he can't really see the moves ahead yet. He's able to work inside structure, I think, but not break it and attack it when he sees that opportunity in the offensive zone. And we've talked about players having the freedom to kind of freelance when they can see a read that says, okay, don't go with the play or as this is structured, do something else. And that can work out for teams who trust their players to have those good instincts. It can backfire in teams who trust those players when they shouldn't. Nazem is in that third group that doesn't seem yet to have those instincts of when he should break from structure and attack. And that's something that takes time to grow. He's still young. There's still runway left, but he has a lot of transferable skills that we talked about in transition. He's gotten better at defending in his own end. He still has offensive abilities, but he needs to show that he can wield those good raw tools and those transferable skills a little more creatively and a little more effectively. That's what's going to get him to take the next step up, because it's like his defense needs to be passable. It's never going to be his calling card. He's not big enough. He doesn't have the strength or the raw tools to defend at a high level and be a shutdown defenseman. So if he's going to make it to the show, it's going to be about what he can do on offense and in the neutral zone. And while he's taking steps forward in all of those directions, getting his defense to be passable, being more aggressive in transition, finding more ways to create offense in the zone, it needs to go further before he's on the Sharks' radar for anything more than a, oh crap, we have five defensemen. Who's the closest to the building?
All right. So victory lap completed. Last bit here before we head off to start bench ship. The model currently has the Barracuda as a 41.7% to make the playoffs. Do you think that they make it? And if so, what are the chances they actually go on a run?
I'll say this right off the bat. It's absolutely silly that the Pacific allows seven teams to make the playoffs. San Jose is 28th of 32 teams in the AHL in the standings. I want to repeat that because it bears repeating. They are 28th of 32 teams in the AHL in the standings. That should not be a playoff team. Like, look, is San Jose had a rough year and had some ups and downs? Yes. Like, their rolling PDO chart is literally a comedy of how absolutely insane and up and down it is. Like, we've showed it multiple times, but I don't feel like you grasp it until you see it every time. It's just, it's wild how much their puck luck has gone all over the place. Look at this.
Oh my God.
It's
funny W's, every time.
Three W's pasted together. That's what it is. Like, so yeah, they've had a rough season, but like the fact that the 28th place team, regardless of who it is, could make the playoffs in the AHL is stupid. Sixth place in the Pacific right now is Bakersfield, who's 21st in the AHL and has a record that's at least close to breaking even. That should be the line. Like, six teams from the Pacific should make it. So that way, if you're going to include 22 teams, the 21st place team making it is fine. There's no way Hartford at 22 should miss the playoffs. Well, Tucson at 27 gets in. That's ridiculous. As for the Barracuda, I think 41.7% is probably around where I would have just off the top of my head ballparked it. I probably would have said a little less, but still, they have a rough, well, actually, now that I know that Tucson is not getting their goaltender back, I'd say actually that's maybe a little low, but they have a rough schedule the rest of the way with away games against Texas, Colorado. They have a road trip left to Coachella Valley. What's interesting, though, is that they played Tucson on the last weekend of the season, and Tucson, you know, could those games are in Tucson. So last two games of the season, games, 71 and 72 in Tucson. And those very well could be for that last playoff spot. So at least with a little luck, we'll get some drama out at the end of the season. Their chances of winning rounds, if they make it, they'll play the second seed, which is either going to be Coachella Valley or Calgary. And, well, I hope they get to see this. Like, for their sake, I hope it's Coachella Valley. No offense to Calgary. I don't know what downtown Calgary is like. And it'll be, like, April, so it shouldn't be freezing. Yeah. But, like, I have to imagine that Coachella Valley is a more desirable destination in early spring than Calgary. Again, no offense, Calgary. I've never been to your city or Coachella Valley. I'm just strictly going on vibes here. But like, I hope they get Coachella Valley so they could at least have, you know, a nice weekend trip in Coachella Valley and maybe get to stay an extra day or so to, you know, have some fun there as they get whopped. Because I cannot imagine a best of three and San Jose beating either of those teams. Not that it matters, because the regular season records, as we say all the time, do not predict playoff series. Stop doing it. But in the humor me department, Sarah, what would you guess in 11 games combined against Calgary and Coachella Valley? What is San Jose's record in those 11 games?
I mean, they had to have won at least a couple. Like, they had to have.
They are 0-11 in the regular season against Coachella.
Well, Calgary. Barracuda, no.
So, yeah, like, if you're going to make the playoffs over Tucson, it's just getting you a long weekend in either Calgary and Coachella Valley, really. Like, sure, you made it. That's great. You know, maybe you get a towel or like a free t-shirt as a season ticket holder for playoffs. But like, you're not getting a home game, because apparently we established last year that even though we're expanding the playoffs, we're not giving teams home games for the first round, or we're giving some of them, but not all. Like, dumb. So yeah, San Jose, they might sneak in. If they do get that, like, last two games against Tucson for a playoff spot, at least that will be fun.
Mm-hmm.
Because the rest of it won't be.
Yeah, I mean, there's a great golf scene in Coachella Valley. Palm Springs is perfect. Full of country clubs. They can head right from the rink the last day to, like, the links and just... done.
If I were the Barracuda or the Sharks organization, like, if they play Coachella Valley in that first round, I would have like a team tea time booked for like the day after that game too.
Just be ready.
It's been a rough one. Like,
yeah,
you're a $1 billion organization. I think you can afford a tea time for 20 dudes.
Yeah.
All right, Sarah, are you ready for Start Bench Ship?
I am ready.
All right. Let's get right to it. First up, Start Bench Ship. The Paddies jerseys that we've already seen from this season. I purposely chose not Chicago's because I know how bias works. But Sarah, Start Bench Ship, Colorado, San Diego, or Wilkes-Barre Scranton? Who you got?
Oh, man. This is really testing my, like, grudge against word marks. I have to start the Penguins, even though it is objectively not an aesthetically pleasing jersey, because I just have such a grudge against the word mark. I'm going to bench Colorado. I do like the plaid. That's kind of fun. San Diego's looks like a Christmas tree. Sorry. we're shipping
I'm
that.
Going to... agree with your choices, but I'm sorry, Wilkes-Barre Scranton is absolutely aesthetically pleasing. That is a great St. Patrick's Day jersey. I will not be hearing
is the logo like in the shape of a clover?
Yes.
Okay, I take back what I said about pleasing, because
I like the gold. The gold, I feel like, really pops better. And is representative of the original Irish flag and not the one with the orange on it. I think that pops so much better. I'm 100% starting Wilkes-Barre Scranton. I'm benching Colorado. I at least, like, even though the, like, shoulders are, oh my God, what's the word? I cannot think of it. It's not plaid. It's
tartan.
Yes. Or tartan. Right. Like, that's more Scottish in my mind. Like, but sure. I also like that the numbers that they used are very Celtic looking, and it was part of their big Pot of Gold charity night, which they did a bunch like of good work in the community. So like, even though I'm benching your jersey, I give you for that. San Diego's is literally their reverse or is their like retro jersey with the colors swapped, and like not even well. Like San Diego's done other really good like themed jerseys or whatever. This was not one of them. Sorry, Gulls. This one, this one's you're getting sent to the coast. All right. Next up, Irish pop culture. We're going with Dairy Girls, Banshees of Inisherin, and a little known Irish comedy, Hard Times. Sarah, I will let you go first here, as your choices are going to be material as to your continuing as a host of this podcast.
I know. Other times I've been like, is this the week I get evicted for making the wrong choice? But this week I really know that if I get it wrong, like, there's going to be an ad on Twitter like tomorrow that's like, who wants to talk about the AHL? No, I'm starting Dairy Girls. I will admit I have not seen all of it. I have seen some of it and greatly enjoyed what I saw and want to see the rest, but there are only so many hours in a day. Also, as someone who like doesn't know a whole ton about Irish history, like I feel like that's a kind of interesting place to jump in to start to learn about like that period of time. It's, you know, recent enough that like you're alive for it and just had no idea what was happening on the other side of the ocean. But very entertaining. All the cast is just really funny. Enjoyed it a lot. I am benching Banshees of Inisherin, which was honestly one of my favorite movies that I saw last year. Felt very emotionally manipulated at one point. I was like, why did this movie make me cry? Like, absolutely unfair. Did not expect that. But very good, dark, also another movie that I was like, wow, sure don't know anything about Irish history. Let me go read some Wikipedia to understand what was happening in the world at this time. I am benching Hard Times only because I have not seen it and therefore cannot have a full opinion on it or shipping it.
Very fair. You made the only clear choice, which is starting Dairy Girls. Like, anything else than that, and you were correct. I wouldn't even wait till you were done speaking before I would just like, starting Dairy Girls is the correct answer. Dairy Girls is absolutely amazing. And when saying that you don't know a lot about Irish history, I'm like, welcome to education in America. Most Americans don't know stuff about Irish history. That's why they do silly things like order car bombs in bars in Ireland.
Don't, not gonna go well. Don't do that one. I know that one. Don't do it.
Or black and tans. Don't do it. No, half and half. I'm starting Dairy Girls, obviously. I watch that show a lot. It is like now my just put something on in the background and unwinds. And some of the, like the episodes are short and they're hilarious. The third season, I literally requested off of work when it dropped on Netflix. I am going to bench Banshees of Inisherin. I still do not totally know how I feel about this movie. Like, parts of it are very good. Parts of it, I'm like, what even is this? Like, it's well made, but there are parts where I'm just like, this is weird. Like, there are a lot of weird things for it. Like, I'm not sure if I like it. Like, I'm still, and I saw this movie like a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
And I still am like having thoughts about whether or not I like the movie.
Yeah.
But it is like, it's well made. It got awards consideration, deservedly so. Like, there are parts of it that you're like, this is well done. And there is no argument about it. But then there are other parts where I'm just like, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Hard Times is a St. Paddy's Day tradition in the O'Brien household. It was when we were looking for an Irish movie to watch, we couldn't find a lot. And Hard Times was one of the ones that we found, and we bought it on Amazon Prime, I think it was, and we watched it. And is it a good movie? Maybe, maybe not. Is it a stupid movie? Absolutely yes. Is it a fun movie? Oh yeah. Like, highly recommends some people going watch out to want like a stupid comedy. It very much, and it's I want to say 2009 it was made, and it's about Viagra. And it's very, like, that's why it's called Hard Times. Like, they're not even trying to be subtle. It is very much, like, if you enjoyed, like, some of the fun American comedies from, like, the mid-2000s, you will like this movie. Like, it's not, you know, brilliant or clever. It's pretty ham-fisted, but it is fun. And I think people will enjoy it if they go see it. All right. Lastly, we are going to dive right into Sarah's bias here. And, oh, that still says playoff teams. That shouldn't say playoff teams. Whoever makes this is just lazy, apparently. But this is going to be American St. Paddy's celebrations. Chicago, Boston, and Savannah, Georgia. Since I kicked you the first two, I will start this one, Sarah. I am going to obviously start Boston. I have been to Boston during St. Paddy's. It is a lot of fun. One of the things on my bucket list that I crossed off was seeing Dropkick Murphys in Boston on Paddy's. Did that, one of the best times of my life. I also learned that Boston has a downtown city planning that was done by very clearly drunk people. Because Boston is, I will never, ever drive in that city. Ever. I drove to that the hotel. We walked from the hotel to the concert, even though it was like half a mile, because I refused to drive. I am going to, bench Savannah, Georgia. I have not, despite having lived in Georgia and being me, I did not go to Savannah, Georgia's St. Patrick's Day thing, but I've heard a lot about it. And it is literally a week long, like, series of events in a place that does not have a ton of Irish people, but for whatever reason, they go with it. I'm shipping Chicago. Sarah, maybe you can change my mind here, but is there more to it than just a parade and we dye the river green?
A bunch of drunk people vomiting on the train.
Is that not just most Blackhawks games?
Usually they're vomiting in the parking lot because taking the train there, no one can ever figure out how to do it.
All right, well, let's at least let you flesh out the rest of your start bench ship here. I'm assuming you are shipping Chicago.
Yes. I am also starting Boston. I've never been to Boston's St. Patrick's Day celebration, but it just seems like if you could pick somewhere in the United States to go to celebrate St. Patrick's Day, why would you not go to Boston? Yes, also Boston was city designed by someone who just threw like noodles at a wall and was like, done. I have never been to Boston without like holding my phone up as I'm walking through the streets being like, what? I like visiting my friends in Boston, and that's about it. No, but like, it just seems like for a good time, go to Boston. I'm also benching Savannah. I don't know much about it, but I think that's kind of unique to have an air like, yeah, Georgia is not where I would think, there's a week long St. Patrick's Day celebration. But it seems cool and fun. I was concerned at first that maybe it was just that fountain. And then I was like, oh, am I going to have to like decide between the like a fountain and a river? But no, and I have a friend who used to live in Savannah and, you know, always spoke really highly of the city and being kind of a cool place to go. I am shipping Chicago because literally all they do is dye the river green and there's a parade. And it's just like, I went out like, so they dyed the river last weekend, not even this weekend. They dyed the river already. Yes. I don't know why, but they did, they do it in advance. And I didn't know that they were doing it in advance. And I was on the train to go to like my own birthday party. And I'm sitting on the train minding my own business. And suddenly it is full of drunk, like 21-year-olds. And I was like, I've made a terrible mistake. No, it is the picture right there is all you need. You do not need to experience it or like, and it is, No, thank you. Everyone is so drunk and annoying. I made a terrible mistake leaving my home that day.
I mean, if they died it a week early, I'm just assuming it was Lori Lightfoot saying like, screw it, I lost.
Right? Potentially.
Like,
and,
three
and it stays green. It stays green for like a significant amount of time. I like, actually the building that I work in might that I used to work in might be in that picture. I used to work right on the river downtown, and like when they dye the river, you're like, oh, it's still green. Oh, still green. Like it stays like that. And it is that like
it says white. Good things about like the waterway if it's right. Still like days later.
Right. Like that the water, like we get our water from Lake Michigan.
Oh, like, that, never mind. I get it now.
It's just, no, thank you.
All right, then. That is it for Start Bench Ship. Sarah, take us out.
All right. Well, thank you all so much for watching. That is it for today. So I hope you had a great time. Today, the Calder Farmstead is a part of the Full Press Radio Network, where you can listen to this and several other great hockey, sports, and sports entertainment programs, all at www.fullpresscoverage.com. Just click the podcast drop-down menu in the top right portion of the website and enjoy.
And if you are enjoying the Calder Farmstead, please make sure you subscribe so you get episodes in a timely fashion. Also, make sure don't mute yourself when you're supposed to be talking. And if you are listening on Apple, Spotify, or Amazon, please rate and review the podcast. Or if you're watching on YouTube, like the video and comment what you thought of the episode. Doing so helps others find the show, and your reviews help us improve it. You can also follow the show on social media at Calder Farmstead on Twitter and at The Calder Farmstead on Instagram and Facebook. Links to all of that and more can be found in our link tree, which is linktr.ee/The Calder Farmstead. Big thanks to Adrian Drake, who made our theme music. You can find him on social media at AD_dysfunction. That's AD_dysfunction. So we can make music for you too. Sarah, where can the people find you?
So my name is Sarah Avampado. You can find me representing Full Press Hockey on Twitter at Right Said Sarah. It's W-R-I-T-E Said Sarah with an H. You can check out my writing at Full Press Hockey, where I talk about the Ontario Reign, or at Kane's Country, where I talk about Chicago Wolves. Sean, where can people find you?
You can find me at on Twitter at SeanO'Brien81. That is SeanO'Brien81. I'm also on Instagram at SeanO'Brien_81. SeanO'Brien81 on Instagram is a different dude. I'm hoping he's figured that out pretty quickly. You can find my stats work, all of the rolling PDO charts, the playoff predictor, eventually at some point the money puck graph. You can find all of that on my Tableau page at bit.ly/data-dump-and-chase, all lowercase, all one word. Sarah, St. Patrick's Day. Have a good one. Thank you for tuning into the show. For Sarah Avampado, I am Sean O'Brien. Please dump and chase responsibly.